You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 20th of September 2014 on Monocle 24.
A feast of print from all around the world, featuring a special retail review here in Tokyo and a report from the conference that's exploring what makes a modern magazine in London. Browse or buy, newsprint or glossy, we've got it all covered on The Stack. Welcome to The Stack, Monocle 24's celebration of all things print with me, Tom Edwards. I'm in Tokyo this week and we'll be taking a stroll through one of The Stack's favourite spaces, Tsutaya Books, with my colleague Steve Bloomfield in just a moment. Back in London, Fernando Augusto Pacheco has been busy at the Modern Magazine 2014 conference. And that's not all, we'll have other reports for you coming up later in the programme. But as you can hopefully hear, we're amongst the hustle and bustle of Teesight, the Daikanyama Tsutaya Books, and Steve is with me now. Steve, this is your maiden visit to Tokyo, in fact, and of course your maiden visit to Tsutaya Books. Are you looking forward to taking a look inside?
I am, yes. Heard a lot about it, read a lot about it in the pages of Monocle, obviously. And yeah, very much looking forward to actually seeing what's inside.
Well, let's go. Come with us, dear listener, as I introduce Steve to the delights of, amongst other things, Magazine Street. 55 metres, count them, of the very best magazines you'll find anywhere on the planet. Let's head inside and take a look. So, Steve, we've repaired upstairs here at Tsutaya, and to the strains of some agreeable dinner jazz, we're sort of in one corner. They've got an extraordinary archive. I mean, I guess, maybe does this take you somewhat by surprise? You don't normally see so many archive editions in a magazine store.
You don't, no, and that's one of the fascinating things about this place, is that, you know, downstairs on the ground floor you've got the most incredible collection of today's magazines. So many of the titles that we see on the stack every week, from Japan, from the UK, from the US, from across Europe, from Australia. But then you come up here and you're in this sort of treasure trove that goes back to, you know, there are, you know, versions of National Geographic from the early 1970s, the Japanese version. You've got versions of Elle, you've got Vogue, you've got, we're in front of rows and rows of Screen magazine dating back from the 60s, in fact the 50s, in fact, no, 1947 I think it starts in there. I mean, it's like it is essentially a library of magazines.
Well, and there's even sort of, you know, Screen ephemera. So next to us as well, we've got Studio Voice magazine, but there's Akira Kurosawa's something like an autobiography, an original first edition copy back from 1982, you know, on sale in the cabinet as well. You've got Andy Warhol looking down. It's an incredible array. And you can also get a pretty handy cocktail while you're at it.
You can indeed. In fact, yes, just over to the right-hand side, there's a very lovely cocktail bar with three or four well-turned-out staff making a few margaritas and whatnot as we speak. But, I mean, yeah, that's the thing that's so fascinating about this, is that you can pick up these old magazines and they're quite happy for you to thumb through, obviously very carefully and without spilling a cocktail on it, but they are not here for show, they're here for people to use and to read.
So Steve, we've wandered back down from, I had to practically physically drag you away from the magazine archive upstairs at Teesight, because I wanted to show you they've got an array of other shops. You've got bicycles, there's cafes, you can hear the buzz of people enjoying their drinks in the afternoon sunshine. But what about the dog grooming centre? I was particularly taken by the doggy couscous that was available. Extraordinary.
Yeah, green dog. Yeah, it is doggy grooming, and there is pretty much everything one would want to buy for their dog, including, I think one would say, some superior organic dog food. Couscous, fusilli, a couple of other things as well.
Amazing stuff. What's your final thought as we stroll back to jump in our taxi up next, as your sort of takeaways from your first visit? Pretty impressive for what could at first appear to be merely a humble magazine shop.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, given that Barnes & Noble, Waterstones and any others in the Western world are struggling to work out how to sell books in actual buildings, Sutara showing the way forward. They've got an incredible selection of magazines, they've got an incredible selection of books, and they're doing it in a very different way. And as we've seen today, it's the middle of the afternoon, the place is packed, it's doing incredibly well. It's a model for others to follow.
In fact, Steve, given you've struck such a positive note there, maybe before that cab we should just pop back in and get a cocktail before we go.
Yeah, why not?
Now, it's not just the retail scene we've got covered here in Tokyo. We also dispatched our Fernando Augusto Pacheco to the Modern Magazine Conference back in London. The event is a must for print aficionados, curated as it is by one of the stack's very best friends, Jeremy Leslie of Mag Culture. Fernando, back in London, takes up the story.
I'm here at the second Modern Magazine Conference, which is being hosted at the London College of Communication in London. After the success of the first event last year, organizer Jeremy Leslie, creative director of Mag Culture, decided to do another one. He starts telling me the difference between the first and the second.
I think the first one was really a kind of launch vehicle for the book that I'd just published. It was never really intended to be a second one, but the response last year was so positive that despite my better judgment, I began to think I would do a second one. And speaking now, in the midst of it all, I'm really glad I did do a second one. I think there's still lots to investigate in this area, and there's still plenty of great speakers to bring over. So people are already asking about the third one.
Were there any specific themes discussed this year that you can talk to us a little bit more?
Yeah, one of the things I was really keen on to move on to this year was still to have a good creative celebration of magazine making, which I think we achieved last year. But this year I wanted to zoom in on one or two particular issues, and one of those which I was pleased went really, really well was to get a number of the significant players in current independent publishing together on a panel and have a discussion about what their role is, what their potential is as a business, how easy, difficult, what are the problems. And that was a very valuable theme, I think, and we got somewhere with that, which was very satisfying. The other thing I really enjoyed was discussing with Adam Moss the way that digital and print have to work together now, and how it was fascinating to hear from him, not just about continued success of his print magazine, but how the content that they're producing is out there now on Facebook and in all sorts of digital and social networking forms. And it was great to hear a positive story around that rather than the kind of, you know, often it gets dressed up as a slightly negative tale.
If I may ask, I mean, you have such a vast variety of editors who came in and give speeches. How do you decide who's coming in? Do people actually maybe suggest themselves, or do you actually approach them?
Well, this year some people did suggest themselves. I didn't always take up the suggestions. For me, it sounds kind of cheesy, but I do approach it like making a magazine, like trying to bring together an interesting group of people and subjects, and then putting them together in interesting kind of pairings or selections, so that it's not just kind of half an hour of him, half an hour of her, half an hour of him, half, you know, so short, long, big magazine, small magazine, new magazine, old magazine, kind of just try and you put together a kind of what I hope is an intelligent mix, which gives a good overview of both big publishing and small publishing.
That was Jeremy Leslie, organizer of the Modern Magazine 2014. There were a great variety of people speaking at the conference today. I spoke to some of them, starting with Rob Orchard, editor of Delayed Gratification magazine, which is all about slow journalism.
I think the name of your magazine says it all, because you're also, I mean, you talk a lot about slow journalism. Was this a reaction of the media that we are, you know, as you say, you know, you have the rolling news channel, I mean, full of fillers, basically.
Yeah. It's a reaction to the extreme speed of digital news production. And there's two problems. One is that everything's got a lot faster and bigger. So there's an intense pressure to get things out, news stories out very quickly and to fill a huge amount of space. And combined with that, there's been a massive disinvestment over the last 10, 15 years in news journalism. We've seen all of these massive titles lose huge subscription numbers and circulation numbers, which obviously means they have smaller budgets and they have less money to play with. And that's combining in quite an unpleasant way to make our news coverage and our news journalism significantly lower quality and less impactful, I think.
I know the magazine comes once every 3 months, but it's still not enough, apparently.
I think there is a problem with a quarterly magazine insofar as you only get to speak with your readers once every quarter. And obviously you can do blog things in between, you can do newsletters, you can do events and so on. There's something very nice about a quarterly publishing schedule, and I don't think we'll ever change from that. I think 3 months worth of news is quite a nice amount to boil down. But I think as we look to the future, we're going to be doing more in between times. So special reports, books, a lot more events, a lot more engagement, and trying to enjoy and be part of this community that is building around this idea.
What I like about the magazine also, I mean, that, you know, the media has some sort of herd mentality, as you said in your speech, and in delayed gratification kind of return to actually the big stories that actually were 3 months ago, but then nobody's talking anymore about that.
Yeah, and what you often find is that when you return to a story 3 months later, after the dust has settled, after the rest of the media have moved on, you find a much different story about that event than was reported at the time. So in our latest issue, for example, we return to the Turkish mine disaster in Soma. 3 months down the line, nobody's talking about it at all anymore. What has happened to the people who have been affected by that? What's happened to the miners' families? What is the politics that's going on in that area? There's some very divisive, very unpleasant politics that's going on around it. Authorities have been trying to play families off against one another, giving money in compensation to some and not to others. There's a fascinating, additional and important human story that's going on there. And that's just, you know, one example of many where being the last of breaking news actually gives you something of an advantage.
How is the business method of the magazine, or are you planning to expand somehow to other forms of media as well?
So the business model we set up with was that we wanted to try to see if it was possible to make a really good magazine just by selling copies. Make the magazine and you sell it for slightly more than it costs to make, and you just see if that works. That kind of works okay. And I hate it when magazines become beholden to their advertisers, and I hate it when they become kind of just vehicles for trying to sell you stuff. So we never want to become that, but I think we are looking at more intelligent ways that we can bring in money so that we can do the sort of editorial projects that we want. So I think things like events, things like these extra sort of special reports and so on, we look at doing some documentaries and possibly getting them sponsored. So trying to be a bit intelligent about how we fund really, really good editorial so that we can expand and so we can do some more interesting things outside of just the printed magazine.
Also in the event, I spoke to Veronica Ditting, art director of a Monaco favorite, The Gentle Woman. She tells me, among other things, what it takes to make an iconic cover.
Yeah, Veronica, I know you started actually A Fantastic Man, the sister publication of The Gentle Woman. Of course, The Gentle Woman is not just the female version of A Fantastic Man. How would you say is the difference in design between both magazines?
A Fantastic Man refers partly a bit to newspaper design and broadsheet with the lines, and it's a very vertical design, so on the text pages, grey paper and use of Times New Roman, and Gentlewoman, I would say, is nearly in some ways a bit more masculine due to the sans serif font Futura that we're using, which is a Bauhaus-related font. But maybe also what's interesting to see is that the text pages of Gentlewoman, well, with the third issue, I'd kind of try to nearly refer a bit to novels and the openness and simpleness. It was just two columns, a bit smaller on the page, and nearly more like a novel experience. And both magazines share a lot of values, that it's about approachability and readability and openness, and also about making typography really specific as well, you know. And so we share many values, and also with the colors, with the treatment of images. I think there are a lot of parallels, but there are also a few differences. And
you just mentioned colors, of course. I mean, as you mentioned in the presentation, a lot of people ask about, I mean, how do you decide the colors of The Gentlewoman? That's why you have such iconic covers in a way, and the color is such an important part of it. You mentioned that actually you react to the image. So it's not that you say, oh, let's have a blue cover and then we play the image. So the image is more important. Then you decide around the image, right?
Yeah, basically we kind of start, we test out a lot of things, but basically we in a way react to the image. So if maybe it's a darker image, you want something which is a good contrast with it. Of course, you also don't want to repeat two colors in a row. Usually it's kind of a reaction towards the image and what we think works best with it, and you need something that makes the image maybe softer, or do you need something, yeah, which gives it a lot of color and contrast and makes it stand out more? So we do test quite a lot of different colors. So it's never really a strategy that we have something in mind beforehand and we just do light powder or pink or something, but really in connection with the image itself.
I know you studied in the Netherlands. How did the Dutch design, may I say, influence your work? I mean, your work in general, but at the Gentlewoman as well.
Well, in general, Dutch graphic design is very content driven and, you know, it's a lot about having kind of a nearly honest feel to the work and not about decorating. It's really not about, never ever about decorating something. So it's really about kind of being quite pure and just letting things be the way they should be or the way they are. And of course, there's attention to typography, there's attention to printing techniques. So I think all those things, of course, influenced it, but I don't think it necessarily looks really like a typical Dutch graphic design example.
In terms of the design of the magazine, I know you're doing since the start. How do you see the changes from the first issue to the latest one with Robin on the cover?
As I said during the lecture, I think with the third issue, design-wise, we really knew what we were doing. I think the first one was pretty much about figuring out what we were and to combine the editorial and the design. And it was much more, even more masculine than it is now and much more pared back and too bare, I guess, if I look at it now. And now I think there's much more detail in there. We've really found a way to combine editorial and design and really shape the tone of voice of the magazine much more. And that may be through little references which are in there or the end notes or how we introduce someone or how images are used. I think, you have to do kind of three issues of a magazine in order to know what you're actually about and what your tone of voice is visually but also editorially.
Tune in for next week's Stack, where we play our final interview from the Modern Magazine Conference, where I spoke with Adam Moss, Editor-in-Chief of New York Magazine.
We're still here outside Tsutaya Books in Daikanyama, and that was Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, reporting from the Modern Magazine Conference, which took place back in London this week. Now, just when you thought the Stack could not get any more international, for you this week, we're going to head to the city that's one of the centres of European publishing. In Germany, independent print magazines are springing out of every possible niche, creating a colourful scene in full bloom. Monocle's Johann Laux went to see Hamburg's first independent mag festival, the Indicon 2014, to chart the territory of this wild flora of print editions.
On German newsstands, independent magazines have been in bloom now for more than a decade. Yet it wasn't until this month that Hamburg saw its first indie mag festival, the Indicon 2014. Publishing collective Die Brüder, meaning the brothers, turned a historic mansion into a laboratory for magazine makers to celebrate independent publishing. I entered the festival to find out what's going on in the German scene. While meandering through the festival's crowd and leafing through all the mags on display, I bumped into an old acquaintance of Monocle 24, London's Stephen Watson of Stack Magazines. Steve and I quickly moved on to the mansion's garden, sat on the grass, and discussed what he's seen today.
Honestly, I'm blown away by what I've seen. I did not expect to see so many magazines that not only have I not read before, but I genuinely have never even heard of them before. I knew that Germany had a really vibrant publishing scene, but I didn't realise that there's quite as much as there is.
Oh, you ended up buying something.
I'll have to dig in my bag and find this because I can't remember the name of it. Here it is. So the Non-Moralist, and I think the magazine's called Sova. It's very rude. I've had a look inside. It's got some very rude pictures, but seems to have some quite interesting articles as well.
So you said you were quite surprised to see the indie magazine scene booming so much in Germany. What do you think? Do you see any reasons for that?
Well, so I mean, I've actually been talking to Oliver from Dummy, and he told me some really interesting stuff about the reason why Dummy is distributed the way it is, and it because of German law, meaning that his magazine by law has to be distributed across a certain number of newsstands, which in the UK is just absolutely unheard of.
Steve is right. Germany is divided by law into roughly 80 regional monopolies for distributing press products. The monopolists are obliged to give out even the smallest magazines with a tiny circulation in order to guarantee freedom and variety of press. Let's hear some of the system's beneficiaries. I spoke first to Dirk Munkemüller, publisher and editor-in-chief of The Weekender, and asked him how his journal for Getaways got started.
We started pretty much as an interiors magazine with like normal people, how they live, a bit influenced by Apartamento magazine. But it developed, and we also selected some travel stories, and later on also food stories came to the mixture. We're pretty open, so there is nobody who tells us what can be in the magazine or what not. So we do it like we think it's correct, and it works great.
And what's on your current issue, the cover story?
The cover story is about going swimming. We have like a picture portfolio from different photographers who sent in their nicest pictures from people going swimming, and also we asked like 10 editors to write about their favorite place to go and take a swim. And that's a cover story.
Next, we are going to hear someone who chose to live abroad and yet remains rooted in German publishing for a very good reason.
My name is Kai. I'm originally from Germany, but I live in Melbourne now, and I publish Offscreen, which is a magazine about people that use technology and the web to be creative, to solve problems, and to build successful businesses. I'm producing issue number 9 now, and all of these issues are pretty similar in their structure. They consist of 6 lengthy interviews with entrepreneurs, designers, developers, generally creative people and interesting people from the tech scene. And as such, we don't really have themed issues or any sort of feature story. It's usually just a very structured magazine that comes out in a similar sort of format every time.
So your magazine is produced in Berlin, but it's in English?
Yeah, it's in English. It's a global magazine. I sell most of the copies online. So I would say about 75 to 80% I sell over the website, and the other 20 to 25% I sell through 50 or so global stockers that I supply directly. But it's printed in Berlin because it's cheaper and because I'm German and I know that the Germans know a thing or two about the printing press. And so the quality is usually quite high in Germany. And yeah, it's also an easier way to ship things around the world because it's basically just cheaper to ship things from Europe instead of from Australia.
So coming from Melbourne today, what do you think about the magazines you've seen lying around here?
There's a lot of familiar ones. There's some new ones. I think I saw a magazine about red-haired people, so people that have red hair, which I think is so far one of the most specialized sort of titles that I've seen.
As the first day of the festival comes to an end, more and more people spill out onto the garden's inviting green. After the first clinks of glasses got in tune with the music, I decided to grasp those editors whose cover stories have caught my eye and ask them to briefly present their magazines.
I'm Josephine, and my magazine's name is Peng.
What is Peng about?
Peng is in German the word for sound when you shoot a gun, and that's definitely not the things what's about in my magazine, but it's about this step to start a thing you want to do. So Peng, start to do it. I think it's the most beautiful magazine you've ever seen. Our cover, it's just our name Peng in very big black letters, and then you see a picture. For example, this issue you see a naked man.
My name is Alexander Scholz, and I'm the creative director and founder of Holo magazine. Holo is about, as we call it, emerging trajectories in art, science and technology. That means that we talk to and visit people that use technology and, for example, scientific data to produce art in a broader sense. So we talk to artists and designers who work in that emerging field, you know, where technology is being used to create interactive installations, data viz and kinetic art, for example. It's a fairly hefty affair. So the first issue that was published in spring 2014 has 226 pages. It also has a 20-page extra booklet that comes with it. One of our core philosophies is, and that's how also how we distinguish ourselves from the web, is that we have a rule of always meeting our featured subjects face-to-face. That means that we travel around the world and visit the artists in their studios, in their work environments, to capture that with long-form journalism and photography.
My name is Mats Panko. I'm the editor-in-chief of Die Epilogue. It's a magazine about social change. That's at least the title we decided to put on the cover. But to be more precise, it's a magazine about the change of everyday's culture. We decided, like, if we want to make something on social change, we want to try to put a modern layout, and we want to make it colorful because we look with we have an optimistic perspective on the future, on the current society, and on the future. The magazine who actually inspired me to do it was the N+1. It's a magazine from New York, and they have like a very straight cultural theorist perspective, way more academic than we are. And that was something I thought, like, if that works there, why wouldn't it work here?
So much variety and euphoria finally took their toll. On the second day, I met with the festival's slightly exhausted organizers. Here's Urs Spindler explaining how they got the idea to create the IndieCon.
We've been thinking about this for quite some time. We started a blog 3 years ago called IndieMags.de, which is somehow a meeting point for independent magazines. We only publish a cover and a few basic facts, so that if you make your own indie magazine, you can submit it and you can find it online afterwards and you can scroll through the others. At some point, we thought that we should really bring this network to life somehow.
And here is Malte Brenneisen with what he liked most about the festival and whether he would organize the IndieCon again in 2015.
What I liked was the discussions between the big elephants and the little mouses. We had editors and chief executive whatever here who are publishing like really, really big shop issues like Brand 1 or like Dummy with Oliver Gass, and these guys earn money and live from it. And the other ones are the ones in the living rooms who are just printing and copying their issues together. And to bring these people together really brings up nice discussions. It was pretty cool. And why not? In the end of the day, you need to pay your rent and the butter on your bread. So if we made just €1 plus, I'd say yes, we go for it.
For Monocle in Hamburg, I'm Johan Laux.
That was Johan Laux reporting on the IndieCon, Independent Magazine Festival, over in Hamburg. Well, that is just about all we have time for on this week's edition of The Stack. With me, Tom Edwards, here in Tokyo. My thanks, as always, to our producer, David Pleasant, and behind the glass, working the levers, if you will, back in London, Claire Urban. Any questions or queries, drop us a note. The usual form applies. And don't forget to book your appointment to tune in to The Stack at the very same time next week. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, here in Tokyo, have a great Saturday. Goodbye.